sweaty forehead and panic face. You will after I've gone and come back 14 fucking times. I have left dozens of plays and ceremonies and services and games and parties and events, and I've stayed home from 10 times as many because my stupid stomach hurt and I had fucking diarrhea. Crohn's disease is an inflammatory bowel disease that causes inflammation of the lining of the digestive tract. It can affect any part of the digestive tract, from the mouth to the anus, but is particularly fond of the small intestine. At least mine is, and she is located in my ileum, the end piece of my small intestine that connects it to my large one. Potential side effects: bone loss, eye problems, back pain, arthritis, liver swelling, gallstones, and skin problems. My joints hurt, and my gnarly skin is disgusting. Can't wait until my eyes fall out of their sockets and my bones shatter every time a strong wind blows. So Crohn's is an immunodeficiency disease, which means that the cells in my body that are supposed to protect against infection don't recognize food and the normal, harmless bacteria that are in my intestine. Let's break it down this way. An innocuous piece of bread is trying to make its way from my mouth to my booty hole. And it's pretty smooth cilia sailing, but only until the second it hits these grody old guts. My receptor cells, which should be like, "Oh, hello food, what's up delicious nutrients?" instead are all "Intruder!" and flood my intestines with little soldiering white blood cells armed to the teeth to fight off the enemy. And while they are entrenched in battle, swords and spears and bayonets aloft, I am in a ridiculous amount of pain, like childbirth pain, real talk, which is typically followed by a torrent of bloody shit and much humiliated apologizing to whomever I happen to be hanging out with at the time. Years of this gnarly infighting, think Capulets and Montagues, Israel and Palestine, Biggie and Tupac, have left my intestines a veritable wasteland of scar tissue. Picture the circumference of your average drinking straw. Now imagine shoving a chicken breast through it. To be fair, a chewed up chicken breast, but I think you get what I'm saying. There are parts of my intestines that are so thick with useless scar tissue that whatever I eat has just that teeny tiny passageway to squeak through. And with all that tussling and fighting going on around it, food rarely survives the journey intact. It just liquefies itself into runny chocolate pudding on a good day or smelly brown pea on a bad one. I have almost reached my lifetime limit of radiation exposure, as I have had 3 colonoscopies, 7 CT scans, 2 barium series, small bowel imaging, and a capsule endoscopy. I swallowed a camera in a capsule that took digital pictures of my entire intestinal tract as it moved through my system until I shit it out. I have had the contents of my stomach sucked out through my nose. I have shit in a bucket every day for 2 weeks and collected samples and shipped them FedEx to a lab. I've had various sections of my bowel collected and biopsied. I have had to vomit while a doctor dude sat and watched and took notes, and I don't mean in a sex fetish way. My ass was hanging out the back of a too small gown and everything. Awful. My GI doctor is supermodel hot. Totally fucking smoking. Oh my lord, handsome as a motherfucker, and it pains me to imagine the ridiculous joke your cruel god is playing on my life. Watching me and laughing his ass off while a Michelangelo sculpture tells me to relax my asshole so he can stick first his fingers and then the scope into it. The first time he asked me about the consistency of my last stool, I almost left my pants behind and ran screaming out the door to get a cab home. It's the very worst kind of humiliation, really. curled up on a cold table, naked from the waist down, lying fetus-style, while a man hotter than any man you could ever imagine getting busy with spreads your butt cheeks and examines the skin around your hairy asshole. And he tries to be normal and talk to you about normal shit. Where do you work? What's your favorite band? What do you do for fun? While he lubes up those dexterous digits so he can palpate your colon. Try being comfortable during that. This is a dude I would be weirded out and nervous talking to while fully clothed and standing at the bus stop, let alone when his face is 6 inches from the crack of my ass. I wish you could have seen my face the first time I shit on him a little bit during an exam. There are no words. I spent my entire childhood with the ghetto diagnosis of weak stomach. You know what the fuck I mean. When black people let your little black ass shit her pants at school, but still don't drag you to a doctor because it's easier to pretend that you just ate too much dinner. I spent half my junior year in high school in the second floor bathroom of Beardsley Hall, the one tucked in the back where the school hid all the ESL kids and that had the least trafficky bathroom. I was always sitting in there, crammed into a stall at the end, doing my chemistry homework and burning up my asshole. So think about the last time you had horrible diarrhea. I mean, use your mind grapes and really get back in that place. That hot, flushed, desperate, churning, panicky, butt-clenchy place. Concentrate. Okay, are you there yet? What about now? Are you afraid you might crap yourself? Or that the bathroom is too far for you to make it in time? That this heavy, immobile, butts-to-nuts traffic won't let up before you get to an exit? That someone will walk into the bathroom, recognize your shoes, then go running back to class to tell everyone what they caught you doing? That the train is going backward because the motherfucker is moving so slow? That your first day on your new job might have gone a whole lot better if you hadn't spent your lunch break in the bathroom across the street at Nordstrom because you don't really know these people very well yet? That your new boyfriend will be totally grossed out because it's your third date and you shouldn't have gotten the flaming cheese and now you're back at his apartment and are forced to ruin the mood in his tiny studio with a big, noisy, smelly, obnoxious shit so you turn on the faucet in the bathtub because it's louder than the sink and you hope like hell he was drunk enough to pass out and doesn't notice you flushing his toilet 13 goddamn times. Welcome to my universe, love, where I do not get to be lovely and delicate and demure because sooner rather than later, I'm going to have to talk to you about shit. When this bullshit is out of remission, my life is a literal shit show on every channel. Imagine the worst diarrhea you've ever had and imagine having that shit every single day. You could light a match on my poor rectum some days, I swear to God. I am the only child-free asshole on the planet with a tube of Desitin in her purse. And in the bathroom. And in the nightstand. And let's be for real, I have a sense of humor about everything, this included. I was finally diagnosed almost 8 years ago, and at the time, I was goddamn mortified. While I was happy to have an answer, I was pretty fucking bummed to have some chronic, permanent shit at age 25. I don't have the genetics required to live to super old age. Don't cry for me. I've come to terms with it. But the prospect of even 40 years dragging along with this bullshit was a lot to, stomach. There is no cure, which is totally fucking awesome. I'd take syphilis over this shit because at least then I could get a shot in my vag and be right back on the horse a week later. In addition to no cure, there is also no known cause, which makes climbing my disconnected family tree to inspect every branch for digestive difficulty even more awesome. My mom had MS, My dad was a vicious drunk with a heart problem. One of my sisters had cancer, while another has had a couple of heart episodes. Where the fuck did this shit come from? I'm supposed to only have a predisposition for gorgeous skin and a fat ass, both of which I got already. Thanks, parents. This stomach shit is supposed to be in someone else's fucking family. I take 8 horse pills a day and massive amounts of steroids when I'm not feeling good. My list of no's is longer than the credits of the last good movie you've seen and includes, but is certainly not limited to, sugar, caffeine, raw fruits and vegetables, alcohol, sweets, grease, cereal, dairy, yeast, beef, pork, chocolate, spice, flavor, variety, and deliciousness. Which is basically impossible to adhere to, and totally the reason I occasionally come frighteningly close to shitting myself on the bus. Sometimes I gotta pretend to be normal, even if it means I have to wear a diaper to book club. I can't order rice and boiled chicken at every restaurant, especially ones that don't have a children's menu. All praises be to the delightfully bland children's menu. Food is absolutely fucking delicious. I should have called my blog, Bitches Gotta Shit. The Tapeworm Diet. It's hilarious to me when people try to pretend not to know why they are fat. Like, really, dude? You eat 3 small meals and exercise an hour every day, yet somehow have no idea why there's a spare tire around your waist? Because if those things were true, you would be skinny. Skinnier. Skinny-ish. Does each of those 3 meals consist of Big Macs washed down with an entire ham? By exercise, do you mean stand up? I've never in my life pretended to have some undiagnosed glandular problem or speculated about a goddamn slow metabolism. I eat bad things and then go to sleep immediately afterward. There. I solved the mystery of fatness for you. You're welcome. So here is why I am a massive, gigantic person. 1, my delicious, delicious feelings. I was never taught how to cope with the batshit voices rattling around in my head. Talking about my kid problems wasn't necessarily frowned upon, but it definitely wasn't encouraged. But we always had comforting little Debbies in the house. Nutty bars, oatmeal pies, all that delicious dollar store shit. And when I had a, challenging day at school, I would come home and grab a Star Crunch or a Raisin Cream Pie, and by A, I mean several. Then I'd build an impenetrable snack fort and read Beezus and Ramona, then take a pre-dinner nap, and when I woke up, everything would be magically better. Food is love, and I was married to cookies. Our family did, or didn't do, all the things that make you fat. Never having dinner around the dining room table, eating right before bed, Kool-Aid in the refrigerator, you get it. I was a chubby little poor kid who ate a lot of snack cakes because boys thought I was ugly. Not to mention the fact that my parents were tired and old, and the only pigskins we tossed around were the ones my father had liberally sprinkled with black pepper and hot sauce. Crunchy. 2. The vegetables I had to finish before I could leave the table always came from a can. And if they hadn't, they'd been cooked with a pig's foot or a slab of bacon floating in the water or some other unhealthy shit, and leached of any nutritional value whatsoever after the 3rd hour of lard-added boiling. I'm not telling you anything new when I say that poor people don't buy a whole lot of fresh vegetables, particularly when they are poor people with young, wasteful children. We ate a lot of Hamburger Helper, a lot of Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat, Shake and Bake, all the foods that had commercials. All that delicious high-sodium shit. Cup noodles, Lipton rice and sauce. You could get cases of them shits for hella cheap. Celebratory dinners at Pizza Hut. Sunday mornings after church at Old Country Buffet. I liked frozen corn and canned peas and probably didn't have a tomato that hadn't been fried or wasn't glistening atop a double cheeseburger until I was a goddamn teenager. 3. If you've never been skinny, the appeal of thinness is less than the tastiness of simple carbohydrates. There's freedom in a double-digit elastic waistband. It's like, what's a handful of Milk Duds if you're already fat? Who cares whether this Coke is diet if you're already at the far end of the BMI? Get in me, movie theater popcorn. I already have a double fucking chin. Yes, I will have another beer. Of course I'm going to finish what's left on my plate. I'm already wearing maternity yoga pants. Let's see how far these bitches stretch. I need to lose some weight, though. Everybody and their mother is always taking goddamn pictures of my motherfucking skin beard, and the internet is already full of my unflattering fatness. Plus, you assholes keep recognizing me while I'm waiting outside Longman and Eagle for Sunday brunch, and I really want you to walk away thinking, OMG, she's totes pretty in real life, and her moles are super understated and classy instead of gross. I really do. I spent half an hour on the elliptical yesterday, and I did the chest press until it felt like my rib cage was going to explode through my tits. But I also had 4 bites of macaroni and cheese with bacon in it. Maybe 5. Okay, 6. I have to get my shit together, friends. But how? The Twinkie Diet. A typical day in the life of Kansas State University nutrition researcher Mark Haub, creator of the junk food diet, which consists of 60% junk food supplemented by a protein shake, multivitamin pills, and a can of green beans or 4 stalks of celery every day. He avoided meat, whole grains, and fruits. September 10th, 2010. A double espresso, 2 servings of Hostess Twinkies, 1 Centrum Advance pill, 1 serving of Little Debbie Star Crunch Cookies, my jam, a Diet Mountain Dew, barf, 1/2 a serving of Doritos Cool Ranch Corn Chips, 2 servings of Kellogg's Corn Pop Cereal, 1 serving of whole milk, squirt, 1/2 a serving of raw baby carrots, 1.5 servings of Duncan Hines Family Style Chewy Fudge Brownie, 1/2 a serving of Little Debbie Zebra Cake, 1 serving of Muscle Milk Protein Shake Drink, total 1,589 calories. Just reading that shit makes my fucking teeth hurt. I think I also might have just caught diabetes through the computer screen. This can't be life, right? Snack cakes and baby carrots? No, it cannot. Nutrisystem. The theory. Losing weight is easier if you outsource meal management chores. Nutrisystem determines portions, prepares and delivers your meals, and tells you what to eat and when. Guaranteed calorie restriction, the tried and true weight loss tactic. The cost? Meal plans range from $250 to $500 a month. In theory, this shit sounds fucking perfect. I spend $500 a month because I have to have the jammiest package with the sickest perks, of course. And in return, I am shipped delicious, calorie-conscious meals that basically do all the work for my lazy, slovenly ass. What could go wrong? The actual cost. $500 plus whatever I already spend on food per month as it is, because I know better than to think that I will be happy and full carrying around freeze-dried celery meals and fat-free pudding desserts. It's like when I used to have a Lean Cuisine appetizer prior to my Lean Cuisine main course. Double the money, still fat. The Tapeworm Diet. So, this is a real thing. It's illegal in America because we hate infectious parasites, but other people in countries that understand how hard it is for a bitch to keep her grubby little mitts off cheese dogs obviously have governments that care about them. These fucking fascists. I want my succubus. Okay, so the idea is that introducing a tapeworm into the body means that the food you eat is split between your own body and that of the tapeworm. You are a host, and the tapeworm uses you by attaching suckers to your stomach and feeding on the foods that you eat. The tapeworm is an additional means of reducing the amount of calories that you absorb without reducing the calories that you consume. The traditional way of becoming infected with a tapeworm is by eating raw meat or by coming into contact with infected feces and or other foods containing tapeworms. However, for the purposes of dieting, methods would include the tablet form. Sounds amazing. Worm-infected meat, totally not gonna die. The grapefruit diet. The 12-day grapefruit diet menu. Breakfast. 8 ounces of unsweetened juice or 1/2 grapefruit, 2 eggs, and 2 slices of bacon. Lunch. 8 ounces of unsweetened juice or 1/2 grapefruit, a salad with low-fat dressing, and 1 meat entree cooked in any style. You can double or even triple your portions if you want. This speaks to me. Dinner. 8 ounces of unsweetened juice or 1/2 grapefruit, a salad with low-fat dressing, 1 red or green vegetable cooked in butter with spices if you are feeling like a fucking badass, and any meat or fish cooked in any style. You can double or triple your entree. Bedtime snack. 8 ounces of tomato juice or skim milk. Recipe for a nightmare. Blech. You also must drink 8 8-ounce glasses of water over the course of the day. I hate grapefruits. Ever since I was a kid, I just can't handle that bitterness the way my salivary glands go apeshit at the mere mention of them. I'm frothing at the mouth right now just typing this shit. Impossible. Next. Slim Fast. Your 1,200 calories a day will come from 3 snacks, half a banana, a pear, or a Slim Fast snack bar, for example. 2 Slim Fast meal replacements, a bar or a shake, and 1 500 calorie meal you prepare. Slim Fast is best for people who need to lose about 20 pounds, which should take 8 to 10 weeks. My sister did Slim Fast once and her farts were bad enough to singe my fucking nose hairs. She burned a hole through the seat of her jeans, not even kidding. We had to keep a fire extinguisher next to the goddamn toilet. I know you think I'm making this up, but there was literal fire shooting out of her butt. It was like living with a dragon. A skinny, fat, cranky dragon that could light the dinner candles with her asshole. The baby food diet. A celebrity fad diet that reportedly involves replacing breakfast and lunch with about 14 jars of baby food, about 25 to 75 calories each, and then eating a sensible dinner. I want to see you bitches walking around with jars of turkey dinner or mango banana peas clinking around inside your expensive handbags. I want to see you on park benches in the middle of the day, daintily eating pureed carrots and beets from those teeny little spoons because nothing else will fit into those teeny little jars. I would die happy. And until Gerber makes carne asada tacos in portable, baby-proof packaging, I'ma just leave this one right here. Being a vegan. In January, I read this article in the New York Times called How to Go Vegan, about how Bill Clinton's decision to adopt a vegan lifestyle totally convinced the writer to try it out herself and almost even made me want to try that shit. A vegan is someone who, for various reasons, usually batshit craziness, just kidding, lolololol, chooses to avoid using or consuming animal products. While vegetarians choose not to consume flesh foods, vegans also avoid dairy and eggs, as well as fur, leather, wool, down, and cosmetics or chemical products tested on animals. I'm too poor and it's too much fucking work. There. I said it. I really wish I was the type of person who owned a Prius and didn't work 50 hours a week and could spend time in the grocery store reading labels to make sure that there isn't a drop of gelatin or honey in every single thing I put in my cart at Whole Foods. And yes, that's an excuse, but also yes, I just can't. I can hardly see straight at the end of the day, and it takes every ounce of the little strength I have left not to make an entire nutritious meal out of the samples scattered around the fucking store. The cigarette diet. Popular in the 1920s. At the time, Lucky Strike Cigarette Company wanted to boost sales, so they used the appetite-curbing nature of nicotine to their advantage. With the ad campaign slogan, "Reach for a Lucky instead of a Sweet," Lucky Strike enticed a lot of ladies to smoke rather than consume extra calories. And the campaign worked. Sales were boosted more than 200% in the 1920s with the use of that slogan. Other tobacco companies jumped on the bandwagon during this time period and promoted smoking as a weight loss method. Skinny and dead from lung cancer. This is not the move. The Sleeping Beauty Diet. Elvis Presley tried this hilarious diet right around the time he had trouble fitting into his trademark 1970s jumpsuits. The belief behind it? If you were heavily sedated for several days, you'd sleep off the weight and wake up thinner. A dream. A literal dream come true. If life was fair and karma was real, I would have an IV in my arm and a spandex jumpsuit on my ass while floating on a bliss cloud made of Dilaudid and propofol. This is probably a sign of some deep-seated depression, and I probably shouldn't admit this publicly, but all I ever want to goddamn do is sleep. I want to sleep, watch wrestling on Hulu on my phone, and eat refined sugar and simple carbohydrates. I'm not allowed to, because life is a cruel mistress, but if I had my way, I would get up every couple of days for a taco refuel and lapse right back into my medicated diet coma. The only downside is that you'd have to be a goddamn millionaire to pull this shit off. So unless I hit the lottery or learn how to sneer while swiveling my hips and playing the guitar, this one might be just beyond my reach. That said, I'm going to the corner store to get some scratch-off tickets. A girl can dream, can't she? Eating only raw foods. Not the same as veganism, bro. Man, who knew? Raw foodies don't cook their dinner, and while I'm sure that preserves all the vitamins and healthy shit, all I can think of is that episode of Sex and the City when the girls ate at that raw restaurant and Miranda said the chunky green soup tasted like lawn in a bowl before eating half a goddamn pizza on the walk home. Okay, so here's what the diet looks like. Raw fish, such as sashimi, ceviche, or cold smoked or cured fish. Raw cheese, such as goat or sheep. Raw nuts and seeds. Raw and dried fruit. Raw and dried veggies. Raw soups like gazpacho and cucumber. And raw meats, such as steak tartare and filet American. Also, cold smoked or cured meats. Sprouted breads, bagels, and tortilla wraps, plus raw cakes, ice creams, smoothies, alcoholic drinks, juices, cookies, and snacks. Hot food is just better. That is my childish answer, and I'm sticking with it. Food should be hot, Goldilocks. Most food should be hot. I'm into this ice cream and alcohol business, though. Raw ice cream could be my new jam. The cotton ball diet. You replace meals or snacks with cotton balls soaked in gelatin, or just dry cotton balls. In other versions of the diet, you eat the cotton balls before meals, and they prevent you from eating too much. The rationale is that the cotton balls contain some calories, and they fill you up, preventing you from wanting to eat anything fattening like real food. Stop it. The cabbage soup diet. The cabbage soup diet is a radical weight loss diet designed around the heavy consumption of a low-calorie cabbage soup over the course of 7 days. Day one, cabbage soup plus as much fruit as desired, excluding bananas. Shit all motherfucking day. Day two, cabbage soup plus vegetables, including one jacket baked potato with a little butter. Shit all motherfucking day. Day three, cabbage soup plus fruit and vegetables, excluding potatoes and bananas. Shit all motherfucking day. Day four, cabbage soup plus up to 8 bananas and as much skim milk as desired. Shit all motherfucking day. Day five, cabbage soup plus up to 10 ounces, 283 grams of beef, and up to 6 tomatoes. Shit all motherfucking day. Day 6. Cabbage soup plus as much beef and vegetables, excluding potatoes, as desired. Shit all motherfucking day. Day 7. Cabbage soup plus brown rice, vegetables, excluding potatoes, and unsweetened fruit juice. Shit all motherfucking day. Day 8, die from dehydration, but 10 pounds lighter. OMG, your shriveled little dried up corpse looks amaze. The blood type diet. The Eat Right for Your Blood Type diet encourages people to eat certain foods and avoid others based on their blood type. What you can eat and how you are supposed to exercise on this diet depends on who you are. If you're blood type O, as in old, humanity's oldest bloodline, your digestive tract retains the memory of ancient times. What? So your metabolism will benefit from lean meats, poultry, and fish. You're supposed to restrict grains, breads, and legumes, and to enjoy vigorous exercise. Type A, for agrarian, does best on a vegetarian diet, the inheritance of their more settled and less warlike farmer ancestors, according to the dude who wrote the book. The type A diet is made up of soy proteins, grains, and organic vegetables and encourages gentle exercise. The nomadic blood type B has a tolerant digestive system and can enjoy low-fat dairy, meat, and produce, but, among other things, should avoid wheat, corn, and lentils. If you're type B, it's recommended you exercise moderately. The modern blood type AB has a sensitive digestive tract and should avoid chicken, beef, and pork, but enjoy seafood, tofu, dairy, and most produce. The fitness regimen for ABs is calming exercises. How do I find out what my blood type is? I've been in the hospital 100 times and have had my blood drawn 3 times that amount, so how come I have no idea what the hell it is? I was too busy sleeping in high school to sell platelets, and now, when I go donate blood, one glance at my medical chart and they're all, yeah right, sick person, I'd rather take my chances with that heroin addict over there. Seriously. The organ donor box on the back of my driver's license reads, are you fucking kidding me? I'm just going to call myself an AB because shrimp is delicious and I refuse to live without soft, stinky cheese. And calming exercises sound hella wonderful. I can chant soothingly with my eyes closed while in child's pose. Let's do this. Bridal boot camp. The woman who came up with this business researched the boot camp training methods of the U.S. military and adapted them for cranky, stressed out, sleep-deprived women teetering on the brink of sanity. She promises that her program will help pissed-off brides-to-be build muscle, shape up, burn fat, and put them on the path toward leading a healthy lifestyle. The program includes 6-month, 3-month, and 4-week regimens, depending on how much time you have until your wedding date. Each regimen includes a specific diet, fitness program, supplement advice, and other information. Every Bridezilla starts out on level 1, which involves an hour of military-style training 4 times a week. Great. Exactly what you need after fighting with your bitch mom for 3 hours about lilac napkins and less expensive place settings. If I ever get married, I'm going to wear pants. Loose-fitting, flowing palazzo pants that don't bunch up in the crotch. Specially made according to my measurements and affixed with some sort of adjustable waistband to account for any calzones or half-price Easter candy I might consume between the time that I have them made and the time I finally make it to the courthouse. I will not be doing any bridal boot camps that will only result in my having unrealistically beautiful wedding pictures that will mock me and my failing marriage until my husband inevitably leaves me and my cottage cheese thighs to our own devices. Don't try any of this crazy fucking shit. I'm going to scrape the icy freezer burn off this pint of Ben and Jerry's Peanut Butter World. That shit is banging, yo. And finish this leftover pasta salad. And then I'm going to pack healthy choice meals that I get on sale at Target in my lunch and order my cheeseburgers without the bun at restaurants. And instead of going to the gym twice a week, I will try to go 4 times. Maybe 5 if there's nothing good on TV. I just toss out all my full-fat salad dressings and gave the college boys across the hall my emergency frozen burritos. Tomorrow, I might even take the stairs. Baby steps. And safer than a goddamn tapeworm. Holy shit. I want to put a fat bitch on network television. My writing partner, Ian Belknap, and I wrote a badass imaginary television show. If I ran the world, you'd be watching this on a premium network right now. The Irby and Ian Project, IIP, centers on Nell, the host of a popular internet radio show, Nell in a Handbasket, where she gives brash, bracingly honest, bawdy but wise relationship advice. Nell's on-mic command and poise is countered by the uncertainty and chaos of her personal life. Like many of her generation, Nell attempts, and mostly fails, to navigate the mind-crushingly horrible gut punch that is modern dating. The IIP also explores the way relationships morph and decay, and people's lives change, marriage, babies, property taxes, parents in elder care, etc. The friction that can arise between friends who have money and those who don't, and navigating the minefield of interracial dating and friendship. Though a bright and self-educated woman, Nell cannot take her own advice. Assured and never at a loss on her show, in her real life, too often Nell feels the sting of getting left behind by those around her, who seem to have gotten a manual for living that she never received. She barely feels like an adult. Her peers are running laps around her on the track of life. Nell is at the center of a group of friends who have surpassed her in the ways that matter. Romantic, financial, familial, and having a sense of purpose. Nell's caught in the trap of being smart enough to be pissed about all the societal pressure to find happiness through a mate and money, and big-hearted enough to yearn for real love and companionship in her life. She's caught between believing she deserves a life mate and believing it's a complete impossibility. Between believing prosperity and fulfillment are attainable and her dim economic prospects. She's been burned many times before, but is too resilient and or deluded to abandon hope entirely. She's totally the kind of person you root for. Characters. Nell. African-American, pretty face, heavy, 30s, host of Nell in a Handbasket, so named for the majestic and inimitable Nell Carter. A bit of an asshole, albeit in an endearing way. She's not a mean person, just somebody who doesn't suffer fools gladly. She vacillates between being a misanthropic loner and being totally charming and personable. Nell is a badass, but secretly sort of miserable and displaced. While hosting her show, Nell is warm, reassuring, attentive, and wise. Hers is exactly the voice you hope to hear when you call the suicide hotline. Off mic, Nell is harsh, sharp-tongued, and surly. Wherever she goes, Nell is the most quick-witted person in the room, so she spends most of her time gritting her teeth and rolling her eyes at the pageant of dumbassery that surrounds her. She's a truth-teller who will give you a decisive smackdown when you deserve it. Though Nell is a towering and authentic force of nature, she's insecure about her looks, her body, everything about her physical self that the beauty industry and media have told her all her life is wrong. The latest indignity? Nell just got dumped for being too smart by a dude who works at Foot Locker, a dude she'd concluded was a prospectless loser. This is just another in a long string of dead-end relationships that heightens her mistrust and pushes her to make progressively dumber choices in men. It's a parade of idiots and scumbags. Nell hosts her show in her tiny, dingy, depressing apartment, dispensing sound and no-nonsense relationship advice. This radio gig pays no money to speak of, but requires a huge investment of her time and energy, so Nell's is a marginal life. She's forced to take a series of hilarious and demeaning and stupid jobs for beer money, landscaping, cater-waitering, painting houses, moving, bike messengering, house cleaning, dog walking, pedicab driving, etc. She changes jobs constantly because she quits the second she's irritated, which is always. She's broke all the time, always relying on money from friends, and in particular her brother Jarrell, which causes enduring friction. Despite her dark moods, her stubborn poverty, and her temper, Nell maintains a mostly positive attitude. Her dating life is absolute garbage, but she continues to try to bag sketchy dudes she meets in dive bars and on the internet. She keeps trying, if for no other reason than the sake of her listeners. She feels an obligation to them to stay in the game and to accumulate interesting, or merely cautionary, tales to tell. Nell jumps on every dating trend, partly to report back on them on her show, and partly because she secretly hopes one of them will pay off. Speed dating, blind dates, Craigslist weirdos, well-intentioned matchmaking friends, and all of which ultimately culminate in absurd and awkward non-matches. Nell's a generous and valued friend, and has a wealth of people knowledge, which makes her exceptional at doling out advice. Her people knowledge ends abruptly at herself, though, so she's kind of a mess. Dan. Caucasian, 40s, pale, haggard, peeved. The computer nerd slash IT guy who produces the radio show. He's the behind-the-scenes guy who keeps it running. White, caustic, and a malcontent and cantankerous bastard. He's grossly overqualified for this pissant job, but hasn't been able to find anything better since he got downsized from a Fortune 500 company 3 years back. He's bitter about working for this scattered idiot, though inwardly, he might concede Nell is quite good at fielding questions from listeners and synthesizing her own experience into helpful stories, but in all other respects is a chaotic wreck. If you put a gun to his head, he might say Nell's a star who, if she got out of her own goddamn way a little bit, could be wildly successful. Dan has much that Nell thinks she wants. A marriage that's not hopelessly acrimonious or dysfunctional. 2 healthy kids. A house he's been barely able to hang on to during the downturn. But he's constantly overwhelmed by the demands of it all. Think Pete Hornberger from 30 Rock. He's constantly reminding Nell, cherish your freedom. I'm on house arrest till these little jerkwads move out. He loves his family, but is burnt out. He pines for nothing more than silence and inactivity. He lusts less after the sexual encounters Nell has, though he does that too, than her freedom. Dan and Nell have an adversarial dynamic. When off mic, they one-up each other with lacerating wit. Their common ground? A near-constant exasperation with other people and grudging respect for each other's skills and smarts. They are bound by mutual need. Her show would never fly without him, and he'd be up shit creek without this job that's beneath him. Nell secretly respects Dan's monogamy and curmudgeonly but loving parenting. Dan secretly respects how principled and bullshit-free Nell is and the courage he knows it takes to follow your own path. Jarrell, African-American, late 20s, fit, prosperous, sexy. Nell's younger brother is her polar opposite. Crisp, put together, ambitious, focused, and responsible. He did everything he was supposed to. Scholarship, internships, career. And their parents, along with society, have rewarded him greatly. Nell resents him, but she desperately needs his sporadic financial intervention to bail her out of jams. So she tries to get along with him in her bristly way. He has moved back to town after an absence of several years to take a promotion and is a little shocked to discover her lack of progress. She hasn't finished college or started a family. She can't hold a job and is always borrowing money she can't pay back. Jarrell is baffled by his sister's attachment to her radio show, since Jarrell has a hard time separating Nell from the lonesome losers who call seeking her counsel. He decides to make Nell his latest project, to make it his mission to life coach her through her many difficulties and ensure that she becomes the kind of success he wants her to be. Jarrell is an overbearing pain in the ass, but he wants what's best for Nell, and she knows it, so she tolerates him and his money. Calvin, African-American, 30s, good-looking, rich. A banker who tossed Nell in the friend zone immediately after meeting her. Nell never got over it, has been sweet on him ever since, and continues to hang out with him in hopes that one day they will have hammered, regret it right away sex or something. He sees her as the sister he never had, the least sexy thing a man could think about a woman. He turns to Nell for advice on his love life, which is agony for her, considering he dates only soulless, third-tier models with vacant eyes and empty skulls. Calvin's the kind of guy who will buy dinner for everyone in the restaurant because he can, and because he's the kind of dude whose main objective is to keep the party going. Fun, kind of fratty, and way superficial. Designer suits, expensive shoes, and pricey sports cars. He's obsessed with the surface, consumed with outward appearances, and unable or unwilling to develop lasting or meaningful relationships. His friendship with Nell is the most real thing in his life, but you can sense that below the surface, he's just using her to up his game with women. He is also the champion of most of her bad choices, encouraging her to keep putting herself out there with men, even if the results could be detrimental to her rapidly deteriorating self-esteem. Gail and Andy. Caucasian, 30s, slim, vital, productive, appealing, based on my good friends Jess and Rodney. Nell's best friends. A contented, energetic couple who are doing everything right. They met young, fell hopelessly and permanently in love, got married, are still totally crazy about each other, and are expecting their first baby. Their house is perfect. Warm, relaxed, inviting, always full of people. A stark contrast to the squalor of Nell's living space and studio. Nell spends most of her free time there, being fed and coddled while she complains about her sex life, etc. Nell hates to admit it, but she envies them. She's also apprehensive about the changes to the current dynamic their new baby will bring. Gail and Andy throw weekly dinner parties to which Nell has a standing invitation. She's always bringing the wrong cheap wine, and her friends are too gracious not to drink it. Needless to say, Dan cannot stand these people. Vanessa and Gretchen, Nell's two good lady friends. Also unlucky in love, they are Nell's close confidants and fellow soldiers in the war against sleeping alone each night. Former high school rivals, they only tolerate each other because of Nell. They are in constant competition, both for men and for the lion's share of Nell's friendship. Vanessa, Caucasian, 30s, slutty redhead. A super fun, morally bankrupt party girl who sleeps with random strangers without ever holding down a real job. Vanessa is happy sport-banging dudes for fun and not giving much thought to the future. Gretchen, Caucasian, 30s, bossy, judgmental. Bitter, perpetually single, borderline spinster who wishes desperately she weren't. Gretchen is engaged in a constantly escalating search to find a husband. She's obsessed with trying to find a mate and have children, but she's crabby and negative and controlling, so men run from her. Nell relies on each of them for different things. Vanessa is there for sexy girl talk and bird-dogging dudes, and Gretchen is always there to bitch about how horrible men are and to go shopping with for sensible shoes. Pilot. Pouring rain on a beautiful tree-lined street in an affluent neighborhood. Parked along either side of the street are sleek luxury cars. Giggling teenage girls run by while trying to shield themselves with a single umbrella. A good-looking man in a sharp suit walks an immaculately groomed poodle while holding a folded newspaper over his head. All of a sudden, you hear a thunderous boom, then another, and a small car comes chugging and rattling down the street, grumbling at a deafening volume. It pulls to a stop in front of one of the houses, smoke billowing from under the hood, and after a few seconds, the passenger door bangs open. Nell, dressed in sparkly party clothes and hooker shoes, emerges from the passenger side after squeezing herself out from under the wheel and climbing across the front seat. She opens the back door, which swings precariously on its hinges, and removes a red insulated pizza delivery bag. She balances the pizza on the roof of the car, wrestles with the door to get it closed, and then takes a second to pull her dress from where it has gotten stuck, bunched into the top of her tights. She has a hard time walking up to the front door of the house, teetering and stumbling in her dangerously high heels. After carefully climbing the steps, Nell is just about to ring the doorbell when her cell phone starts ringing. You can see her briefly agonizing over whether she should answer the phone while technically at work and standing in the rain, but she goes for it. She balances the pizza in one arm while trying to remove the phone from her bra and nearly drops them both a couple of times before she finally gets the phone to her ear. She answers the phone and stands there listening for a good 10 seconds, shoulder slumped, clothes getting soaked through. The door inside the house flies open, and on the other side of the glass door stands a middle-aged white man in sweatpants and a t-shirt that totally doesn't fit in with the surrounding neighborhood. He looks really pissed off. He opens his mouth to say something to Nell, but she holds up a finger to shush him, and he responds by sighing angrily and looking at his watch. She says to the person on the phone, "How the fuck can you break up with me? You work at fucking Foot Locker." She slams the phone shut and pulls the pizza box from its protective carrier and tells the owner of the house what he owes her. He pointedly looks at his watch again and puts his wallet away. 31 minutes, he says smugly. That pizza is free. Nell begins to defend herself, and he counters with a lecture about being a responsible employee and how she isn't even wearing a uniform. And rather than continue to listen, she opens a screen, throws the pizza at the man, then storms down the walkway to her car, which is being ticketed by a cop. She half-heartedly attempts to flirt her way out of the fine, but the officer isn't going for it, and so she snatches the ticket from him with a defeated sigh, opens the passenger door, and climbs back into the driver's seat. She opens a glove compartment and shoves the ticket in with what appears to be a dozen others. Then she tries to start the engine, which won't turn over. She tries a couple more times, screaming and swearing and banging her head on the steering wheel, until her tantrum is interrupted by a hard knock on the window. She looks up, startled. It's the dude with the pizza, and he's psychotically angry. Next scene. Nell, now carrying the heels she'd been tiptoeing around in, is walking down the street of a much dirtier neighborhood. Men catcall and playfully reach for her as she walks by, and she glares at them. She's got a sad, wet pizza box tucked under one arm, with an empty plastic gasoline container perched on top. Her tights are ripped, and her hair has dried awkwardly. She lets herself into a tiny apartment, kicking clothes and garbage out of the way as she tries to get in the door. The apartment is messy in a calculated kind of way. Paintings and artwork lean against the walls, hundreds of books are stacked on the floor and on chairs, and piles of clothes and takeout containers are scattered across the floor. There's what appears to be an unmade futon in one corner of the room, and in the corner opposite, there is a desk that has a nice computer and a bunch of electronic equipment balanced on it. She sets the pizza box on the floor and plops down on what looks like a large pile of blankets on top of the futon, but that pile screams in pain before shoving her roughly to the floor. We see that there had been a gentleman sleeping under those blankets, and Nell turns around, incredulous. "You broke up with me," dramatic pause, "while sleeping in my fucking bed," she screams. And we see a look pass between them. It registers on both faces that she's going to punch him. She takes a big swing and barely grazes his jaw as he jumps out of the way just in